Welcome to Channel 9 of the STRY Radio Network, where stories live.
Welcome to the Ninth Story Podcast. This is Season 6, Episode 5. I'm Immortal Alexander.
And I'm Jeanette Andromeda.
We're a podcast about writing, and today's topic is How Do You Write for Young Adults?
To help us with this topic is young adult fiction author John Kluwerth. Welcome, John.
Good evening. Thank you very much for having me on.
So, after talking to John in the interview portion of the Wicked Library, we had such a heavy geek out conversation that just continued after what actually ended up in the episode. So I wanted to have you back on. And this time we're talking about writing for a young adult audience because you kind of specialize in that.
Yes, I do. I always find it difficult to categorize what I do because I write what sort of I'm a bit organic, really. So whatever comes to mind, but I do find that I tend to gravitate back to what I suppose you might loosely describe as young adult. And I think it's very difficult. I've got a couple of books out. And if they were to be sort of, you know, verified like a film certificate, you'd probably get different opinions on them because young adults are very difficult to write for, but in some ways they're easy. Mm-hmm. So I do specialize in it. Maybe it's something to do with the job that I'm in as well. So I hope I've got a lot of the narrative voice right by working with these young people. Well, they tell me anyway if I've not. Which is good,
but
you know, I like to. I've done some middle grade stuff and some, some old stuff yet, but nothing really of sort of novel length. So yeah, the books are mainly young adult. Mm-hmm.
So if you guys haven't heard the interview with him on the Wicked Library yet, John is also a teacher and he teaches what age range?
It's 10 to 13 years.
There you go. That is not an easy age range.
It's a very interesting age. We're one of the few in England. We don't have many middle schools left. It's called the middle school, from age 10 to 13. And I mean, if you think about it, the changes that go on in that are absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
They're coming in year 6, really squeaky. By the time they get to year 8, you know, all the voices have gone, they're broken the voice and developing mustaches and things like that. So it's a really sort of interesting phase to watch, and some of it can be very inspiring for characterization in stories.
So is that the main reason, John, you decided to take on young adult fiction, is because you actually teach young adults as a, you know?
Yeah, well, to a certain extent. I mean, I've taught for many years now, and I've normally taught younger kids, so it's been, you know, through to up to the age of 11. But in recent years, the past 3 or 4 years, I've kind of gone back to where I started, which was up to 13. And I think that's partially why I specialise in it. But I think the other thing as well is that when you're a teacher, and two, when you write for young adults or children, you can get to access some really good material. The market's really strong out there. And I think some of the young adult stuff is better than the actual adult stuff that's out there. You know, it's a really competitive market, and there's some fantastic, challenging reads there for them. So it's a really good one to tackle.
Well, and I also think that, like you were saying, the young adult market has this kind of spectrum because it is, you have these kids who are still very much children starting to read more adult content. And that's where I think the horror starts to be something that they're drawn to You are a young adult and you're figuring out who you are and where you are in the world. And it's just like this interesting space in mental maturity that ends up in this just huge array of young adult fiction out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the kids themselves, you know, as they're starting to develop, mm-hmm. you know, the first thing that happens really is that you get this massive shoot up, and, I'm teaching boys that are bigger than me, and I'm kind of 6'1", and they're 12. So, They're bigger than me. And the feet grow and the bodies grow, but the brains don't grow at the same rate. And then you get this kind of mixture of hormones whizzing around the body, and the moods start to change. And, you know, they get into quite I think they become more interesting and become more interested in the kind of stuff that I write, you know, because the feelings that are inside of them, you can tap into, and you can manifest it in different ways in stories, and actually tap into it for them to enjoy. And it's a kind of escapism with a safety net, you know. I think you've got to be careful when you're writing for young people. As I say, I've written some adult stuff, which is pretty strong, and I wouldn't share with, you know, a younger audience. But I don't tend to back away from the themes, which, you know, are pretty universal throughout any kind of literature, really. You know, you're looking at themes like betrayal, loss, loss of trust, you know, family members turning bad or whatever, you know. Friendship's a massive issue in friendship circles. And just, you know, the way that they actually relate with the adult world and the strangeness that brings on is all kind of confusing but fantastic at the same time. So it's good to tap into that, and I think they enjoy reading about it as well.
I definitely think so. And for you as an adult, what kind of ways do you work to get into the headspace of this younger audience?
Well, that's a really interesting one, because, I mean, as a teacher, you try to do that anyway. And it's kind of, it's not an easy one to answer, because sometimes you just don't know where they are. Sometimes they're kind of almost on another planet. The best thing to do really is to, when you're in a kind of a privileged position as I am, is to just observe. And I'm also, I play in my job, I play a big pastoral role. So I'm the head of year for 200 kids, at the moment, aged between 12 and 13. And they bring with them a variety of needs. So what's inside one kid's head may be pretty much, you know, like Polly Pocket and My Pony and all that kind of thing. Whereas in another kid's head, you know, it's all zombies, you know, cannibals and all that kind of thing. So it depends on your character, really. Mm-hmm. And I think working with them and communicating with them on a daily basis helps me to understand more about the way that they think. And again, when I'm counselling them, when they need, you know, advice or help or whatever it is, I speak to them, and, you know, you get an understanding that way. And you can actually use that. You think, oh, that, you know, that kind of thinking there would be good. So why did you act in that way? And they will often verbalise it if you ask the right questions. And, you know, writers are all poachers anyway. So, you know, we're there, you know, like pinching ideas from everywhere, aren't we? You know, and so the kids are dropping these little golden nuggets in, and you say, oh, no, we could use that. So it's kind of it's difficult, but it's good fun to try and get into the consciousness or get into that headspace. Mm-hmm. But the key thing is to try and keep it true and to keep it ringing true. You know, sometimes they'll just say, oh, we'd never say that, you know, or we wouldn't react in that way. If most of the time you can hit it right. So it's almost like a meditative process of taking yourself into the way that they would think. And actually, I think, you know, sure, many writers would agree, I can't speak for them all, but that when you are writing a character, you have to almost become that character and shut off the rest of the world and not speak as you and not think as you. But, you know, how would my character react? And another tip, that I use when I'm doing characterizing, I'll write down maybe a list of questions, whichever character it might be, so, you know, to get into the kind of young adult ID, you know. So, you know, what's your deepest fear? What's your most embarrassing moment? What's the high spot of your life that gave you the biggest buzz? What's your favorite color? Little things like that. And if you can familiarize yourself with that, then you've got things to hang your character on, and hopefully then they relate to it, you know, in the right way, and we'll keep coming back for more. So they seem to be enjoying it at the moment, so it's all good.
And I think it would be interesting. I mean, if as a writer, if you wanted to attempt young adult fiction, I think you could go out there and just volunteer your time teaching youths for anything, even just some community stuff, where you can have an opportunity to observe and use that information as just notes, not like specifics about a person, you know, their own personal life, but like just little things that you pick up on because you get a chance to observe, like when they do a nature documentary and they observe the animals in the wild and their natural environment. They're like, oh, I'm just going to sit here and hang out in a tree and watch this bird for a couple hours. You can't really do that with young adults without officially having to be there for a reason.
Absolutely.
I'm just sitting in the park watching children. Yeah. It's okay. I'm a novelist.
Yeah, well, that would explain it then. Yeah. No, it's true. And I can't remember which writer it was that said it, but I think it was something along the lines of, I know it's probably more than one writer that said it, but in order to write about life, you've got to get out there and live it and write about what you know about. And then, you know, obviously with horror, as horror writers, we write about things that are fairly surreal and hopefully won't happen.
Yeah.
You know, because there's enough of the, I suppose, you know, real horror in the world.
I think
so. The horror that we write about needs to be an escape that you want to go to.
Right.
You know, and I think, so I think getting out there and amongst them and talking to them, whatever you're doing, you know, it's all part of the research really, isn't it?
It definitely you is.
Know? So I get paid for doing research.
Lots of marketing. and on this thought, there's just something in your book, Firestorm Rising, that just really highlights this moment with like how kids react to a situation as opposed to how an adult would react. And there's a scene when they're in the attic, and I will try not to spoil the scene because it's so magical.
Oh, no.
But something appears, and then there's a lot of water involved, and then it's just like they're more worried about their parents being mad at them because of the water damage than like this thing that just happened.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that's the way that kids react. You know?
I mean,
they can do the most extremely bizarre, silly, you know, surprising things. And they go, why did you do that? You know, but imagine it's sort of a life or death situation. Yeah, and but they'd be more concerned. Oh no, you know, we've wet the carpet. Yeah,
we gotta deal with this. My mom's gonna actually kill me.
Yeah, now that is real horror.
You know?
If I really want to terrify a child, you know, don't write horror. Just say, I'm just picking up the phone. I'm going to ring your mum.
Please, God, no. It really is. Like, that's the biggest thing.
Of course, I would never do that. But it is, sometimes it's a good bargaining chip, you know?
And, John, do you draw at all from your own experiences when you're writing?
Yeah, I do. And I think these thoughts and ideas can come from anywhere and everywhere, you know, and sometimes it might just be, you know, one word that intrigues me. And sometimes it may be a place that I've visited or a dream. I wish I could have more nightmares. I love nightmares. So lots of cheese and red wine, you know, before you go to bed, that's the best combination. And you know, I've had some brilliant nightmares, and I tap into those whenever I can. Trouble is, I forget them too quick, you know. So, you know, kind of the dreams are like that; they just slip away. But I mean, in my past life, in my earlier life, so like I've been reincarnated now. I used to be a miner, a coal miner. So you know, I've done the sort of, you know, disappearing off into the dark at 5 a.m. I've been in places underground where there actually has literally been nobody else and hundreds of feet of rock above me and all around me. Very, very spooky.
Yeah.
And then when you turn off the light on your lamp, on your headlamp, you experience total blackness, which we never really experience. You know, because as soon as you turn off your light, you see shapes and your eyes begin to adjust. But total blackness down there. And they actually have real blind mice that come out when you turn off the light. It's very weird, very spooky. Yeah, they come out and sort of search for the crumbs. I'm speaking historically now because unfortunately most of them are past now. They're not, you know, it's not an industry that's survived. Mm-hmm. So I've been down there and I tapped into all that, and I used that one in Demons in the Dark. Mm-hmm. There's a scene there where it's underground and part of the finale happens under there. So you can draw on that, and actually, you know, I've been in that cage. I know what it smells like. I know what it feels like. You know, the cage is basically the thing that they lower you down in. And you go down underground, I think any life experience, and as you go through life, I always think it's a bit life. I'm not going to burst into song, but it's a bit of a roller coaster, you know. And it's got its high spots and its low spots. This is what I always say to the kids, you know, don't worry about it, because this will go back. The ride will go back up again. Mm-hmm. You know, you're feeling a bit down at the minute, but it will go back up again, and you can use those times. When you were feeling down, or when somebody treated you badly, or when you've seen something that you found really offensive or appalling, and I think you can take that, reshape it, and channel it into something new, exciting, and artistic. So, yeah, very much so draw on my own life experience and try to use that wherever possible, sometimes fairly literally, you know, as in describing a journey underground, but sometimes, you know, in a more hidden way, where an experience that you've had, you know, a powerful experience, can come into a story, and it can be disguised in a different way. But it gives you that real feel. I think it gives that authenticity. And then, you know, the bits that you do dream up, I think you can get away with those much more, because the people, you know, the readers have bought into that sense of, you know, suspended disbelief. But it's quite a good analogy, and I think as I say, you know, it's really good to you know, to experience new things, and to throw them all into the pot, you know, and to, you know, yeah, and you know, to jot them down before you forget them, because it, you know, life is so transient, and ideas. I think it's a bit like a soup, you know, the ideas that you come up with in your head, and stuff that you've maybe not even thought about for years can pop back up, and you get a little idea, and if you don't write it down, it pops back down again. So I try to keep a record of it as I go along. Yeah, life's rich tapestry.
So, kind of changing gears a little bit, do you believe that writing young adult characters in peril can actually be more effective in creating dread because of their age? Because you definitely play with that in your stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think it can create, and this is where, you know, there has to be a note of caution, because I think maybe being a professional who works with kids as well, mm-hmm. is that, you know, you understand that there's a fine line that I personally feel you know, you need to be careful not to go too far beyond, because I see, you know, young adult writers as the custodians of their literature. We don't own it, you know, they own it. Mm-hmm. We're just looking after it for them. And I think, you know, yes, you can create dread within them, but as we've maybe touched on, you know, earlier in the conversation, there are so many feelings going through them at this age anyway, that it's, you know, those feelings come up and they can't make sense of them. You know, so, yeah, you know, I just feel like the whole world hates me today. You know, those kind of feelings. And you know, you get a lot of, sometimes I think maybe over-analysis and of, you know, depression in children, and these black feelings. Yeah. So as with anything, if you can turn that into a kind of a fuel and an energy, because there is an energy in that kind of feeling, and that's what fear is. It's an energy. And if you can channel it and use it in something creative, then I think the kids can get a lot out of it and can actually make sense of it and say, yeah, you know, it's okay to feel like that. I get it. That character on that page, I felt like that. I understand. Somebody else understands as well. And that little moment, you know, when they do understand that they're not the only one that feels like that, it's quite a moment of epiphany for them. Because they often feel quite isolated as a process of this. So you can tap into those feelings of dread. And I think when you want to push the fear buttons, it's quite easy. But I don't tend to go into anything too. I'm not afraid to put the sort of graphic imagery on the pages and the themes, because I think themes are universal through any kind of age range, you know. As we mentioned before, you know, like friendship and love and hate and trust, those kind of things are there anyway. So it's kind of just tapping into those, but in a way that's not going to damage them, because writing should be fun, reading should be fun. And at the end of the day, you know, I see it that you kind of take them by the hand, you're leading them into the dark, and they know at the end of the day it's just a book or it's just a story,
right,
or it's just a podcast that you're listening to, and you can, at the end of it, you can switch it off. You've had a good time with it. It's escapism. And, you know, it's a place to go to and to welcome to go to. And speaking from personal experience as a youngster myself, when I was that age, there wasn't the swell of stuff that there is out there now. There was very little. You know, you used to have to get straight into pretty much James Herbert, Stephen King and people like that, and the pan books of horror and all that. But I used to love it, you know, because it was satisfying, that kind of darker side, which, whether people admit to it or not, everybody's got, you know, and you can tap into that. And I think you can satisfy that darker side. And these, you know, kind of feelings within the kids, they can relate to that. So it's a tricky but a really rewarding thing to do and to write for. And I love connecting with the kids and talking to the kids. I think that's one of the best things about writing, is actually getting out there, talking to them. And perhaps, you know, sometimes they're more eager to talk, you know, present company excluded. but, you know, sort of most people, you know, don't tend to discuss literature too much. You know, like, you know, what was on X Factor last night or something
right.
like that. Kids are more into, oh, yeah. Yeah, I read that, and oh, have you read this? And you know, and all the latest great movie that's out there, and so they will discuss it, and they can ignite pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So you've got to catch them when you know you've got to catch them when they're ready, and just kind of hit that note. So it's a bit random in some ways, but a real good challenge. So did that answer the question there?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I do drift sometimes. You have to tell me if I ramble
too much.
I'm
enjoying your drifting.
Exactly.
Oh, good. It's on good. Topic drifting, so it's okay.
Absolutely.
So, John, how do you approach language and vocabulary, knowing that you are writing for a younger audience?
Yeah, two strands to it, really. One is that I'm obviously, again, in a position where, you know, I'm working with children all the time, so I learn the kind of subculture, the sub-language, if you like. Every playground, every schoolyard has its own kind of subculture, things that they don't think the adults know about. Mm-hmm. And you can have real fun with them, you know, sort of talking old, in inverted commas, you know, using, say, hey, that's really groovy, you know. But you get things, you get phrases like, I don't know if you're familiar with, is it mint? Mint. Mm-hmm. This might be an English one. I don't. Mint is good. What is it? Peng. Peng is good, but deng is bad. So that's peng, that's deng. Peng's good, deng's bad. So, so you can filter those in. Trouble is they go out of fashion quite quickly, because they can change them again by, you know, next month or something. Mm-hmm. And the other strand to that is I always avoid profanity in young adult. To me, I don't think it's necessary. I think I can pack a punch without, you know, without using offensive language. It's not something, you know, that I'm, you know, sort of on a soapbox about. I just feel that I think kids are more intelligent. They don't need, you know, the kind of blunt instrument. Mm-hmm. The actual changes that are going on within them are very, very subtle. And just as sometimes you might want to present a real kind of splattery image, you know, and a bit of a, you know, either somebody exploding or something like that, which they can have fun with. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you get a good descriptive phrase on that, they'll love that.
Yeah.
But what really works well, though, is the kind of more the shadowy things, because that's what really scares them. Mm. And I think in terms of, I'm not drifting from the question here, but in terms of, you know, the what you don't see, it's what's that thing just around the corner there, almost like a camera just panning around a dark corridor. What is it at the end? Our school, by the way, is supposed to be haunted. That's great, isn't it, for me?
That's awesome.
It's fantastic. Yeah, from the caretaker, caretaker's wife, actually, janitor. So down the end of the corridor, she stood there and she showed me a picture on her phone of this kind of shape. And apparently it's a little girl that's, there was a, previously it was a children's home or something like that. And this little girl has been seen walking the corridor. I've never seen her. I've walked down in the dark many, many times. I'd love to see her. Don't know what I'd do if I did, but I'm drifting from the point, but there is a point to this. So just as you might walk down there, and it's that kind of, well, what you don't see. And as personally, as I'm walking down that corridor and kind of thinking, I really want to see this. And part of me is thinking, I really don't want to see this. You know, what would I do if that happened? And it's those kind of questions, what if, and what you don't see. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same with language as well.
Yeah.
You can do it. You can make your point without, you know, hammering it in with offensive language. If it comes to a character that would necessarily speak in that way and it was necessary to the plot, then, you know, I'd throw it in. But I don't find the need too often. So I think in terms of language there, again, it's that, you know, a note of caution. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with a real kind of on the cusp kind of, you know, between childhood and adulthood. Mm-hmm. And in there, you know, you're in a real privileged position. If you can access that in any way, you can make a real difference.
Yeah. People are formed in that time frame of life. And kind of on that thought process, there's this idea of like what's too far for a young adult audience is like there are stories where the lead cast of characters are young adults, but the story isn't for that audience. Like the first half of It is all about young adults, but I really wouldn't want a 13-year-old to read that book because
you probably find that most of them have
probably actually, but it's like, and then I guess that's my question is like, having a cast of characters that is the age doesn't necessarily make a story for that age group, but where is that line?
Well, I think, are you referring to the movie? Have you seen the new movie?
Yes, we have.
That was brutal.
I've not seen that. That's in my calendar, I think, for next weekend or the weekend after that. We might have another one lined up first. I'm really looking forward to it. I read the book years ago. And I think Stephen King, I mean, obviously, he's popular for many reasons, not least of which is just an absolute genius at characterization. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great to take, you know, kid characters and put them in those situations because, you know, many books, you know, particularly serialized books, will, you know, begin with a younger character and then develop that character as they get older. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, adults can have a good time reading the younger stuff,
yeah.
You know, and not feel that, you know, you're reading down because it's really talented writing. I think kids can still have that same reward reading upwards as well. It's just that, as you say, Jeanette, there, I think, you know, there are certain maybe themes and things that something that would absolutely terrify me, I would think I wouldn't want a youngster to see because, you know, we can bend back into shape quite quickly, much more quickly than they can. And I think also that as adults, we can see more, and this is a big difference, that we see more that difference between the divide between reality and unreality. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you speak to a young child. So for example, a year six in my school, well, year six is 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. They will happily talk to you about some fantasy thing as though it's quite real, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're out there and there's dragons out there and fantastic and don't go in that cupboard, it's haunted. And it's quite real and they've no, you know, no sort of modesty about it. It's just there. It's that, you know, that's quite real. But as, you know, as they get a little bit older, and the feelings start to change. You have to be very careful how you kind of deal with that side of things, you know, because things that can be enacted on the schoolyard need to be closely monitored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
You know, even things like, you know, WWE, which I love, by the way. Oh, I love it. You know, The Undertaker and all that. But, you know, they become that character and think, yep. They don't realize that these guys are highly trained and that they don't really hurt each other. You know?
We have friends that used to do backyard wrestling, and they would try not to hurt themselves, but they're using their own makeshift ring and makeshift everything. So, you know, stuff happens, but you don't want to encourage it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, but so I think those kind of themes, you've got to be careful where the lines are drawn, and I think it's just a judgment call, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't think anybody's quite got it right, because some kids can be ready for, you know, quite more mature literature quite early on.
That's true.
You know, and I think that's why it's so difficult. And books don't have really, some do, maybe rough ones, don't have age categories on them, do they?
Nope.
But, you know, so, I think, there are certain themes and, you know, that kids, I think, quite rightly need protecting from. And you can hint at and you can refer to, but the meat of the stuff that they're into really is into the scares and the action. You know, and how the main character, I think they like to see themselves reflected in that character. You know, so you've got like, you know, I like to try to develop a strong female character. Mm-hmm. So within both the books that I've written and hopefully lots of the stories that I've written, you know, there's a reflection of a little bit of everybody in there, you know, you know, for too long, you know, the girl characters, certainly when I was growing up, when, you know, when you were watching Doctor Who and things like that, they were all there just to kind of stand behind the guy,
yep.
a little bit, which is not what women are like at all, you know, and rightly so. And so, you know, teaching young girls now, they are extremely competitive, and you know, and they come through. They like to see that reflected in the literature. Yep. Otherwise, they close the book and they choose another one, and that's not what you want.
Nope.
So, John, what is a good length for a young adult novel?
It's difficult, because, well, I mean, of the two that I've done, I mean, again, very difficult to categorize, but the Demons in the Dark one is probably the more, young adult one of the ones that I've got out at the minute. Although I have got a draft of a latest one, and that runs in at, just under 70,000. Mm-hmm. So I think the going sort of concern, and again, I think like many writers out there, I'm not agented. I'm not with a big publisher. You know, there's such a great indie market out there now. But the guidelines in terms of what agents are looking for is probably about right, which I think with young adults is somewhere between 50 and 80 mm-hmm. thousand for young adult. And, you know, you kind of it's got to be really, really, you know, sort of, I won't say good, but unique in a way to sort of go beyond that, I think. But anything below that, and I don't think there's enough meat, you know, to digest there.
Yeah, because after, like, lower than that, it seems to get into the not even middle grade, but even younger, where you suddenly start to need more pictures again under that word count of, like, 50,000.
Yeah, I think you're right. And again, you know, that's just teaching English to students of the age that I teach, you know, right from 10 to 13. Some kids are reading challenging long books, and several of them, you know, every week. And it's absolutely fantastic to see. And I've read this one, I've read that one, you know, what are you on to now? But again, it goes with the maturity and with the concentration span and how much they can handle. You know, so, yeah, the middle grade, you know, or younger, you know, shorter chapters, pictures. But by the time you're getting onto the young adult, you know, you're into the more abstract kind of ideas. Mm-hmm. And you can develop those over a longer course, really. So I think that's where they're up to, you know, on that next step then before the step up to the adult stuff.
I think that makes sense. So you touched on this subject before, but one book that comes to mind is Tolkien's The Hobbit. It kind of feels like an introduction to a younger audience so that he can kind of bring people into the Lord of the Rings series, which was a much bigger, beefier thing. But in its length and language is what's different between the two books. And I'm curious, do you shy away from complex topics in your young adult writing, or like the depth of language, like description and things like that? How do you approach that knowing that it might be a younger reading level?
I think, you know, in terms of the language, it's just finding that right pitch into, you know, because I mean, as an adult, I've read books where I've needed to have a dictionary at the side of me, and I've kind of been looking at this author's just trying to be clever. Mm-hmm. What are you trying to do? You know, trying to use the most obscure word possible. Mm-hmm. So I think the language, I think accessibility, you can do ever such a lot with really simple language. So the language itself really isn't a problem, and the complexity of the language, I think it should be there to challenge them. Mm-hmm. And help them to grow as readers and, you know, and thinkers. In terms of the topics themselves, I don't tend to censor myself too much. In fact, sometimes I wonder if I do go a little bit too far. There are a few little rules that I tend to live by when I'm writing. Well, so far anyway, for young adults, is that I've not killed off any children yet. not in my young adult stuff. They might think they have, but then it kind of, you know, I can sort of twist it around and I've got things up my sleeve. So I tend not to do that. The overly offensive language, and I think, you know, things like sexual content, you've got to be so careful with. Mm-hmm. That you know, it's just it's not necessary. If it is, it's, you know, it's in terms of, you know, romantic and kind of these romantic ideas that kids get when they're growing up. So but I think more the terms of the in Demons in the Dark, there was one where this, you know, the kid's relationship with his dad was totally different, and his dad turned out to be something other than what it appeared to be all his life. And he'd done something unpleasant to mum, and disposed of mum quite early on in the story, without giving too many spoilers away. And he met a very sticky end in the end. And I really painted that quite graphically. I went quite a few pots of paint at that one. But the kids seemed to enjoy it. Yeah, he deserved that. I don't think, well, no, he probably didn't actually, but I thought you might like it, you know. Yeah. You know, there were a few bones cracking and splintering and blood bubbling up here and there. So I think in that, you know, you can have such fun, because it's almost, you know, it becomes a kind of it's a big finale and it's the just desserts. But I tend to kind of measure that out if I can, because mm-hmm. they're the kind of stories that, you know, I enjoy reading, are the ones that make me think twice about turning the light off at night. The ones that, you know, kind of, you know, maybe wonder what that is out the corner of my eye, what it is that's tapping on the window outside, you know. Mm-hmm. Hopefully nothing, you know, apart from a tree. But those are the kind of things that that work really well. And an author that I like that does that extremely well, and if you're familiar with Susan Hill and The Woman in Black.
Yes.
But those kind of stories are just so intense and brilliant. And I think those are the kind of things that kids enjoy as well. Mm-hmm. Because, again, it taps into that sense of unease. But you can bring about such a whoosh and a rush and a release of, you know, whoa, fantastic. It's a relief. It's over. And, you know, it all turns out, it turns out well, or it doesn't. It depends what money comes. You know, but I'm usually on the kids' side. And I like the hero. I like the heroes to win. But I love baddies as well. Yeah, I would have loved being a bad guy. I would love to have been a villain. You know, because I'm just so squeaky clean in life. It's you know, it's one of those things I kind of relate to. We're watching Gotham at the minute on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, the fantastic new series of that out, And, you know, I love all the villains in there. It's just so dark and brilliant and brooding. So, yeah, I think that's the things that that kids like. And those topics and themes, quite easy to tap into, because you could sum it up into one word and you say that, you know, it's feelings. It's getting into those feelings, mm-hmm. and those emotions, and using them into something creative and artistic. It's kids like that.
Definitely.
And John, I know we kind of touched upon this a little bit earlier on in the conversation, but something like a Harry Potter as a series seems like a great example of a series growing emotionally as its audience does. How do you write a modern feeling story for young adults that won't become too dated in just a few years?
It's really difficult, because, I mean, just an example that comes to mind of a short story that I wrote, and it was the internet was developing apace. Mm-hmm. I wrote an idea about that and I didn't actually send it out anywhere. I never really finished it. And then I read it again and I thought, that is so dated now, because the technology's moved on. That wouldn't happen. This wouldn't happen. So I think you've got to be, you can either create something that's of a period. Mm-hmm. And I love writing that kind of stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, the one that I just had in the Wicked Library was a kind of turn of the sort of, you know, early 1900s kind of story. And if it's of that time, you know, you're safe because things are there and they're there in history. Mm-hmm. But more keeping that modern feel now, I think, again, and I sort of would always come back to the point that I think from, you know, the day we first sort of crawled out of the primordial ooze and started to walk on two legs, we've experienced fear, we've experienced joy, and I think, you know, however long we last on the planet, we're still going to have those feelings, and those feelings never really go out of date. Mm-hmm. So I think if the thrust of the story is based on tapping into that, then I think the rest of it is almost window dressing,
yeah.
You know? And, you know, they will go, oh, yeah, that was from the, I don't know, that was from 2000, or, yeah, that was around then. But those feelings are still the same. They'll buy into that and sort of travel with you. But, yeah, I mean, Harry Potter's a brilliant example of that. And I remember buying the first one when it first came out and read it in one sitting, I think, and really enjoyed it. And then the complexity of the books grew and became darker. Mm-hmm. But still, kids are accessing that now really voraciously.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the modern audience are picking it up and they're through it within a matter of months and having a good time with it.
I love it. I Harry Potter, I was very lucky to grow up with myself. So it was like, oh, my goodness, am I going to get my... No, I didn't have magic. Apparently, I'm just a muggle, but
just a muggle. So yeah, it's a great story, and I think story like Harry Potter and you know, success stories like that, uh-huh. are fantastic. You know, writing a story on a napkin, you know, and a delayed train journey, you know, giving the time to mull over a crucial point, you know, in the plot that developed it through to that first thing. It's brilliant, and then it takes on a life of its own.
It does.
It's a kind of magic in that, for sure, in more than one way.
Definitely. That's kind of the magic of writing.
Yeah.
So as I've been reading more of your work, I've noticed that you really are very good at having a broader spectrum of characters in your stories. So the fact that you often have a strong female character, I love. How does the actual gender of your characters influence the tone, style, or language of them as you're writing them?
It depends on who the character is. Mm-hmm. So you get, you take, you know, a random selection, a straw poll of 10 kids. You get 5 boys, 5 girls. Even within, say, one class of English that I teach, the kids all speak in different ways. You know, because I'm teaching one girl at the minute she's a really keen footballer. But you might describe as a tomboy, mm-hmm. But absolutely delightful kid. And, you know, is in some ways, her speech is more boyish than the boys, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you've got to be really careful again to not really just stereotype and say, well, a girl would speak in this way, or a British kid would speak in this way. You know, so going, oh, that's frightfully nice, isn't it? And and the girl going, oh, yes, it is. You know, so I think the characters that I wrote, so say, the Firestorm Rising one, she'd got the spiked hair, the coloured hair. She was a real fighter, you know, and there's a sequel in the pipeline for that as well. Nice. So there's a little bit to her than meets the eye. And, you know, the two boys kind of played off each other as well, you know, the way that they sort of interacted. In fact, one of them was really quite neutral, and it maybe came across as the hero, but it was the other two that really made him that way. Mm-hmm. You know, the feisty female character and the kind of the more sort of deep thinking other lad. So yeah, I think the way to deal with gender is almost, I think these days, to put gender on one side and to think of them as what is that individual like? Mm-hmm. What makes that person, you know, the person that they are. I think the way that they handle situations and the way they respond and react, you can show so much more than tell. So I think the tone again depends just on the character. The language can be, you know, can be quite disparate depending on, you know, what you want to portray. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you've really got quite a good melting pot and a good palette to mix things on these days. And that's where, you know, when you do look back, and you were mentioning earlier about things going out of date, mm-hmm. you know, so you look back at kind of things like Enid Blyton, you know, it's still hugely popular, but it's of its time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a snapshot in time. And I think kids and society have evolved so much since then. And in many ways for the better. In some ways, you know, and you could say, you know, maybe not so sure, but... Well, that's life, and that's the whole sort of rich tapestry of it, isn't it?
Most definitely. John, since you do a lot of your own, you do your own publishing, correct?
Yes, yes.
So how do you go about marketing books to a young adult audience, knowing kind of how they consume and where they look for these things?
Well, I'm in a slightly more lucky situation that just very briefly, when I first put Firestorm Rising out, I signed a publishing contract, and several people had signed up with this publisher, and it fell flat. They couldn't deliver on the promises, but I got to know some really nice people. Mm-hmm. And one of them set up the publishing platform where I put my books out from now, which is Mauve Square. And we're kind of all in on that and have an interest in keeping that going. And who knows where that might lead, mm-hmm. you know, eventually. When we take on kind of more authors, but it's very, very early in the stage, and we're kind of pursuing individual projects. But in terms of marketing the books out, it's more, I've really got into social media and, you know, using Twitter mainly, but I've got a website and Facebook page as well. But I just love the face-to-face things and getting the chance to, you know, work with children in school, but also in other schools as well. And I think, you know, the nice thing, again, with kids particularly, and with young adults particularly, that if they like something, they'll shout out about it and they'll tell each other and they'll tell their friends and, you know, they'll spread the word. So a lot of it is just word of mouth. And I'm sure, you know, as writers yourselves and, you know, and any writers that are listening in, when you're on that journey and you're first setting out on it, you think, oh, you know, people are going to snap this up. Mm-hmm. They're going to love me. You know, they're going to buy this straight away. And then the rejection things start coming in, you know, usually.
Yeah.
What? I don't deserve this. And then you start talking to people and they go, you know, you need to grow another skin. You need to become broad-shouldered because that is just part of the writer's life. And yeah. It's all in the eye of the reader. One person's opinion can be very, very different to another. But kids tend to be very honest. And if they like it, you know, they'll come back for more. So I think in terms of marketing, you've not got certainly not got a publicity machine behind me like many of us. Things like being able to reach out on podcasts like this, fantastic Ninth Story, getting work out on the Wicked Library. Oh, you're welcome. And those kind of things, and also the face to face, wherever there's an opportunity, visiting a library, doing a workshop in a library, or doing a workshop in another school, is just, even if you pick up just one or two people in a new audience, word of mouth is a really powerful advertising tool. And I think if your product is right and polished and good enough, then people will start to think, oh, I'd like to hear a little bit more of that, or I might explore him a little bit more. So in that sense, it's kind of, I just feel I'm really energetic about it, I'm really passionate, and I would never become complacent. I think all writers should learn that lesson, that you if you let it go cold, it'll stay cold. You've got to keep the momentum going, and be your own best marketer to a certain extent. And all publicity is good publicity. I think so anyway. And all work to do with writing is good work, because it's getting the word out there. And it's spreading the messages that we want to spread, that books are good. Stories are here to stay. They've been here since the dawn of time. They always will be. And, technology changes, but stories don't. The things within them don't. So, it's just no longer just sitting and tapping way behind a laptop in an ivory tower. There's a classic idea of that. You got to reach out, and I just think that the writing community is just a fantastic, wonderful community. And as I said before, I'm kind of discovering this side of things with the podcasts, and it's a whole new avenue of really great people that I'm learning about, talking to, working with. It's a real pleasure and a joy. So in a way, that kind of marketing's easy and enjoyable, but you've got to work at it.
And now with like Twitter, you have to be really kind of cautious as far as how you promote your products, because you don't want your Twitter account to just become a place where you put product placement.
Did you hear I had a book?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you having a conversation? But I have a book.
See? Like that. Buy it. So like that's a thing that you really do need to be cautious of, because if they just see you as a sounding board, as a promotional sounding board and nothing else, not as an individual, not as a creative or witty person, they're going to get turned off. But if you can be a human being that's also creative, it's also a writer, and talk about all those things through your social media and occasionally put out that, I have a new book, I think you're going to get a lot more attraction as an individual.
The remembering to actually... It is okay to say, hey, I have a book you can buy. I really enjoy Twitter, and I'm going to go a little off tangent for a second, because I think this is valuable information, because half of it is marketing what you have out there. And with Twitter, I've been very good about just being like social and a person, talking about random things that I think are cool. But it wasn't until recently I started to actually say, oh, hey, guys, I have prints. Do you want to buy them? Oh, my God, you do. Why didn't I mention this sooner? Says everyone.
But it needs to be that way around, Jeanette, doesn't it? That's the best way to do it. Become the person first.
Yeah.
Build a relationship with whoever you're following. And then sort of pop it. I read a tweet earlier on today, and it just made me smile. It's somebody that I follow. We've kind of followed each other since I think he came onto Twitter, and he interact quite a lot, and he puts lots of funny stuff out there. But then he put on oh, by the way, I've written some quite nice books if anybody would like to buy them. I just thought, that's fantastic. Yeah, I'll dip into that. I'll have a look and see. And I think that's a lot better way to go at it. Because you're quite right, Alex. When you're on Twitter, however many followers you've got, you skip past that, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
The ads that come, you can see it's just, oh gosh, there's they're not in it to invest in you in any way or interested in what you're doing. They're just there to try and sell a product, and it becomes almost background noise. Mm-hmm.
They tweeted like 3 weeks ago or 3 months ago as their last tweet about their last thing they put out. And then three months later, they come on and they push the button again. They're like, oh, yeah, book. And then leave.
Like they're all going to rush out there and buy it.
Yeah.
I think a good way is that as well, as well as kind of interacting with, your followers and the people that you talk to on Twitter. Getting involved, and I like to get involved in things like we call it UK teen chat and UK MG chat, UK young adult chat, groups that, every couple of weeks or so for an hour, we'll have a discussion about a different topic related to that. And you know that the people that are on there are there to interact and give you something important to listen to. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not just to say, I'm selling this book or selling that book. And sometimes it'll be, we've got so-and-so, the author of this book, is our guest today. And you can talk to them about their process of writing. And it's a much more rewarding thing. And I think social media used correctly can be an absolutely brilliant thing. It does have its pitfalls, but I think you can spot a kind of almost a robot that's spitting out adverts a mile away, can't you?
All it does is mean I know you don't pay enough attention to your Twitter account to ever respond to me. It's like, oh,
yeah,
I got a DM. Oh, it's
a
robot.
It makes it look like you're active, so it improves your analytics. But that's it. It's not really improving your actual penetration into the market. You're not really getting people to want to look at what you're putting out there because they have to like you first. If they like you, they'll more likely to click and check something out. It's just like if anybody puts anything out there with like a link to somewhere else or anything, if they don't know who you are or they don't like you, they're not going to trust you. Once they trust you, like, okay, sure, I'll check out what this is. Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Which totally happened to I bought your book because I was like, oh, I just had this great conversation with this guy on the Wicked Library and I want to read what the heck else he's written. Mm. I'm really enjoying Firestorm Rising, by the way. I'm not all the way through it, but... Oh my God!
Oh, excellent!
It's hilarious.
Oh, thank you. yeah. I think that was hilarious. The word that you used there. I think that's such a good word to use because I think I've been there are two things that I've been described as a writer that really I consider hugely flattering. And one was when I was a teacher training, and we did a creative writing unit, and people were writing all kinds of mundane stuff, and I wrote something really sick, and it was like the lecturer, or whatever it was, moderator said, wrote three words: brilliant but sick. Yes, back of the net, goal, fantastic. And what was the other one? I can't remember the other one. Oh yeah, that something I had a chapbook out, sort of thin, few stories. Chapbook called Bloodshot, long since out of print, but isn't in the early days. And a reviewer said that, and I think this was a really nice thing to say, that I'm equally comfortable laughing in the dark as out in the light, something like that. He has this ability to laugh in the dark, and that kind of sums up his work. And so I do love to lace humour in there. I think it's so important. I can't help it. It's kind of that organic thing. And I think that's maybe part of the voice that you maybe sort of recognise as maybe one of my traits. There's always a bit of fun in there. I mean, there's such humour in life, isn't there?
There is.
Yeah, there is.
And in horror as well, particularly some of the things that are not supposed to be funny are really hilarious.
Exactly.
That's funny.
There's so many, I won't even bring them up, but there's so many things just already in your book that I'm just like, I am sitting there giggling to myself because it's just like a funny moment, but
I
love it. I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, thank you so much. I am glad. I mean, that's the best kind of feedback that you can get. And I mean, the kids tend to like it as well. And as I say, they are quite honest, and they will sort of go, hey, it's really, And I don't know whether it's this sort of insecurity of being a writer or whatever. And you always have that bit, don't you? Most people don't like it. You know, what if it's rubbish? What if it's not what I think it is? And every time a kid or somebody like yourself goes, "Yo, I'm really enjoying that." And wow. And I wrote that, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a great feeling, isn't it? And you say as fellow writers, you'll understand that. You know, it's the kind of. It's a real buzz that you've kind of given birth to this thing, and somebody's having a good time with it. You know, it's job done.
Exactly.
Speaking of your alley, where can we send people to find you and find more of your work?
Right. The best place to find me, really, if you want to communicate with me, talk to me, and I'm very happy to interact, is on my Twitter account, which is @JohnCluarth. Just my name. Mm-hmm. I've got a website which I update quite often, you know, it's fairly infrequently, but that's at www.johncluarth.co.uk, I think it is, or .com.co.uk, and it's Dark and Spooky Tales, it's called. So there's lots of information on there, and snippets and little links to pages from the books that I've written if people want to dip into those. I've got a Facebook page as well, which when anything's new is coming up, I pop on there. So if people want to pop along, interact, have a chat, great to get to know you. It just builds that wider community. Hopefully you'll enjoy the sea.
Heck yeah. So, John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so
and
much.
For sharing your plethora of knowledge on this subject.
Well, you know what? I've really, really enjoyed it. And Jeanette and Alex, thank you very much for having me on this lovely show.
Thank you guys so much for listening. This has been the Ninth Story Podcast with Jeanette, Alexander, and our guest, John Clearworth. And thank you, John, for joining us today.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review on iTunes. It helps more people find our lovely little podcast and join us and be a part of this whole community, and that'd be wonderful. So please leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to us.
Write a review and more writers will join.
If you want to find out more about this particular episode and the topics we discussed, you can go over to podcast.ninthstory.com/S6E05.
We'll see you there, my friends.
Hello, welcome to Skype call testing service. After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
Big black bugs bleed blue blood.
Big blue bugs bleed black blood.
Big blue bloods bleed black bugs. Oh God, why? Why? Please make it stop. Why? Black bugs bleed blue blood.
Big blue bugs bleed black blood.
Big blue bloods bleed black bugs. Oh God, why? Why? Please make it stop. Why?
If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly.
Amazing.
I am
amusing.
If you hear
this message, but not your own voice, then something is wrong
Skype
with your audio
lady.
Recording settings.
Aren't you
Please
amused?
Please check your microphone and microphone settings
Skype
or visit
lady.
Skype.com
hey.
For more help. Thank you for using the Skype testing service.
Hey.
Goodbye.
Aww.
Aww.